From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in intentional Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. Normally, here's where Ellen says that she makes nice games, Steven chimes in and says that he makes nice games, and I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games. This week, Ellen and Steven are stuck out in the Minneapolis rain. No, that didn't happen, but it is just me this week as I bring you my talk from last month's IGDATC game dev meeting, Your Game Has a Message, Did You Write It? And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. That's right, it's a format break this week. We have done this before. This is a talk that I originally wrote and gave for MDev, which is a game dev conference in Madison, Wisconsin. Gave this talk at their event late last year, and I always kind of hoped I'd be able to use it as an episode of the show because the talk went over really well, and I wanted to share it with our audience. Unfortunately, it wasn't recorded at that conference, but I had another opportunity, and what was good about it for me, and you'll hear it in the back half of this episode, is a really robust Q&A. This happened at the MDev version of the talk, and it happened again at the GameDev meeting version as well, so I was very pleased that it brought out a robust conversation from the attendees. So actually what you'll hear is you'll hear my talk in the first half of the episode, and then the back half is entirely Q&A. But I promise you, no one has more of a statement than a question. It was a really interesting conversation with really interesting people from here in the Twin Cities game dev community. If you want to watch the video version of this talk with my slides and everything, you can check that out on our website, nicegames.club, at the episode page for this episode. It'll be embedded right in there. I will say you get a little bit of context, especially there's a little video presentation in the middle, but the audio version works just fine. You're not really missing out on a lot, but there is a format where I have things on slides for a long time that I ask people to consider, and you'll be missing out on the opportunity to stare at that as I talk. So it's all up to you. Another fun topical thing is we talked recently about off-screen gameplay, and I tried to explain how much I really like that concept when Ellen brought it to the clubhouse as a topic. And we get into it again here as part of the Q&A, which just proves that everything is everything and it all leads back to the same topic in the end, which I will also talk a little bit about in the thing. So why am I talking about what this is going to be instead of just sharing with you? I should just be sharing it with you. So here you go. Here's my talk. Your game has a message. Did you write it? All right. What to expect from this talk? The main thing is that you don't have to accept my thesis yet, or ever. I think you'll still be able to get something out of what I talk about from the examples that I cite. It's going to be three case studies. And each case study is going to have some questions. So I'm going to prompt you with, like, what does this mean? How do you think about this? And the idea is that it's a sort of Socratic seminar. So keep your answers to yourself for now. But after the talk, I want you to share them with anyone who will listen. And I want to open up a discussion. That's the key about this. Because my premise is about how to approach these things. It's not really the answers to the questions that I'm going to offer. All right, so the thesis. Hey, everybody, remember ludonarrative dissonance? Yeah, that's exactly right. It was a term coined in 2007, and we all got tired of hearing about it around 2015, I think, which is a long time ago now. But the idea is that your gameplay betrays what your narrative is trying to say, right? That's the dissonance between the ludo and the narrative. It's very cute. It's very fun. But I also think that we're sick of the term because it was overused. But I think that says more about games than it does about the term, frankly. I think it's still a valuable structure by which to view things. And I think we're all like, all games sort of, you know, you kill a bunch of guys and then the cutscene has you crying over the death of one person, blah, blah, blah. We get it. But I feel like, no, that's a huge problem, everybody. Like, I think we're really comfortable with those sorts of things. And I think using it as a to your advantage is okay, right? There's no reason that your gameplay has to align perfectly with your story. That's hopefully not what people take away from that concept. But that dissonance is still something really valuable. And I think we've dismissed it a little bit too quickly because we pointed at every game in the universe and said, this all has this problem. And then the result we took from that was like, well, then it must not really be a problem then. And I think that's the wrong thing that we took from it. Because meaning is hardly ever delivered by story alone, right? If you have a really, really compelling story, and you see this in AAA a lot where those departments are very much separated from each other, you have this incredible story and you only ever see it in the cutscenes. I think that's a problem. It doesn't make the story worse. It just confines the story to the story parts of the game. And I think that is short-sighted as an industry because mechanics, that's the goal. That's the power we have as games, is to make things and say things with gameplay. So, you know, example people use, Uncharted story, lovable rogue who murders 1,000 people, that we're sort of okay with that. But the game's intended message is not about not killing people, right? The you don't walk away from that game with a message of nonviolence. So, like, is it really a problem that Ikili murders 1,000 people and they don't talk about it? Like, maybe it's not really a problem. But if it's not really a problem, what is it then, right? What does that confusion do for us? What does it say to us? And why can't we make a game that has that dissonance, but then we can say something with that dissonance, right? It's not just about saying, oh, people will put up with it. Oh, it's okay. It's the language of games. Like, great, let's have those things be different. Let's make them even contradictory, but like, let's do it on purpose, right? Let's not just do it by, you know, by accident. I think The Last of Us is a better example of something that really does have a lot of narrative, narrative dissonance in it. It's basically this story about how killing is wrong. That's like, that's a core function of it. It's so torturous and, but you have to kill people to get through, to complete the mission, to save humanity, or to decide not to. You know, to be able to put yourself in that position, you needed to do horrible things. And that changes you as a person. But man, that game is fun. Like, killing people, so much fun in that game. And sneaking up and choking them out, or, you know, sniping them off, or running away, and oh, my heart is beating, but then I'm gonna kill them all. Like, that's a fun game. And it doesn't take anything away from how fun that game is, that the story doesn't just support that. And it doesn't really take any away from the story that the game is really fun. But it does mean that those things do not support each other in a way that I think is kind of embarrassing. And it's embarrassing that we lavish so much praise on a game like that, because those two halves are both stellar. But because they don't really align, I feel like we should be interrogating that a little bit more. Games are designed to develop iteratively, right? If it's not fun, you got to make it fun. You got to make changes. But, you know, what happens when you playtest, you QA, the game's getting better, it's more polished, the story's coming across clearer because you're not just QAing the mechanics, you're QAing everything about it or playtesting. But what happens when the message gets in the way of your other goals? I want to make a really fun game, but I also want to say a thing. But man, when that message gets across to people, they are having no fun. So that's the choice you have to make. All right, that's the thesis. Again, take it or leave it. I'm going to lay it out here in three case studies. The first one is chess. Chess is a war game. That's pretty well known. The genre is abstract strategy. So it's, you know, pieces on a board. But chess is less abstract. Even though chess is like the abstract strategy game, it's less abstract than most abstract strategy games, right? Checkers is more meaningfully abstract than chess is, because chess has characters and you can embody meaning to, and it has a narrative and it has, you know, it has story, and it's a war game. So it's a war game that teaches empathy. So what it does is, in order to be good at chess, you need to know what the other player is going to do. And in order to know what the other player is going to do, you got to put yourself in their shoes. You have to imagine that you only know what they know. You also have to imagine what they know that you don't know. That requires an incredible human superpower of empathy, right? In order to be good at chess, you have to be an incredibly empathetic human. You need an appreciation of the goals and perspectives. You need to know that, I'm going to try this gambit, but if I'm them, are they going to fall for it? And I have to imagine a scenario where they do, and imagine a scenario where they don't. And I have to think, what do I know about this person from our encounter, or from if it's a friend you're playing against? And how can I leverage that and know what they're feeling and how they're thinking based on what I've done, independent of what I know about the situation? And that becomes a skill. That's a skill you can apply in the rest of your life, right? You know, it's Sun Tzu shit, right? Like, know your enemy. So it's, I mean, that's one half of it. But it leads me to the sort of conclusion of this thing, because I used to think this is a really powerful thing when I understand this concept. Like, oh, that's amazing. Chess can really make you a better human being. Except it doesn't really teach it like a philosophy, because famously, high-level chess players are like jerkwads. That's like a cliche. It's not always true, but it's kind of always true, right? You hear this a lot, and part of it is because high-level chess players make chess their whole lives. They lack the social skills that you get, you could be very good at with the skills of chess, but if you spend no time on that, so it's this weird contradiction, the way that chess works, because it's not a team sport, right? The winners will stand alone. So even though you spend a lot of time thinking about what other people think, you never really think about you never think about the philosophy of their perspective, right? You will just think about the strategy of their perspective. So it's kind of, it's like misplaced knowledge. And I think that can turn you into a jerkwad. So was chess designed to hone bad attitudes as well as strategic minds? Like, I really don't think so. I mean, you'd have to go back hundreds of years, but I can't imagine that was anybody's intent as the game evolved, because it wasn't always the way it was. The history of chess is super fascinating. So here's my question. So this is the thing. I'm going to run through these. I'm going to show them all at the same time. Start thinking about this. What would a really proper empathetic chess even look like? Would it even still be a competitive game? Maybe it's a team game where you are not allowed to communicate with a player who is on your side, but you need to use those skills. What other unexpected games can you extract meaning from? Like, does Pong say anything to you? Does Asteroids, Space Invaders, right? Are these games that were, you know, sort of famously designed very quickly around very tight technical constraints? Do they teach us skills or messages or philosophies that we didn't understand them to be intended to do? Is it okay for your game to not want to say anything? So this is definitely true of abstract strategy games. The discipline of making those types of games very often is about not wanting to think of anything other than the abstract strategy. Is that even possible to do? Could you make a game that there's no way you can extract any meaning from? And what work do you have to do to make sure that whatever lessons you don't want to teach are not taught? And what happens if you discover that your game says something you didn't expect? Do you try to, this isn't what I wanted to say at all, right? Do you want to change it? You say, you know what? This is actually kind of interesting. It was almost the opposite of what I was trying to say, but it's interesting also. It's better. Let's lean into it. But in order, I think, to answer that question, you need to have a really good literacy of your own work. And I think that's something that we don't take seriously enough as designers. So think about these questions, jot them down, ignore the rest of the talk. If you've got something really in your mind or one of these and you really want to talk about it later, they're there for you. All right, case number two, Super Mario Bros. Wii. It's a Mario game, I love it. I love all Mario games. Co-op Mario, super cool. No playable Princess Peach, famously. You got them two toads. But the reason for that is because Peach is kidnapped again. Okay, fine, it's a Mario game. They didn't want to make too many changes to the formula. The co-op was excuses, right? So, you know, blue and yellow toad, they just solved that equation, right? That's what they decided to do. Instead of saying they wanted to have Yoshi be rideable so they couldn't make Yoshi the fourth player. I think they invented Nabbit later on, or they didn't quite make Nabbit a playable character yet. This is just where they landed. So that's fine as far as it goes, right? I don't think that's a good excuse, frankly, but setting aside the fact that Peach is kidnapped again, making a game four-player co-op actually changes what that means. It doesn't just mean that Peach is kidnapped again, because it's not impossible. You can't ban all stories where a man saves a woman, right? Like, there's context to that. But like, just saying you can't do that anymore isn't really the solution. I think Mario should stop doing it, and they have. But four-player co-op makes that something else. The problem really isn't that Peach is missing. It's the blue toad and the existence of Super Mario Bros. 2, where Peach is a playable character. That was a reskin game. Everyone knows that story. But Peach has been a playable character before. So we all know that history, even if you never played that game. So this game says, when forming a party of heroes, a photocopy of a man is preferable to a woman who has previously excelled in the role. That is what this game literally says to its players. And I doubt that's on purpose, but that is horrendous of a message to take away from it. But it's the first thing I thought of when I saw that lineup. Because the context matters. It's no longer about who needs rescuing, because that's a complicated conversation and that's been talked to death. It's about who gets to even be a fourth-rate hero. Like, Peach wasn't good enough, so they photocopy of Toad. That's awful. It really is awful. And I think it's unforgivable is what it is. I still love this game. So let's think about where Nintendo was thinking about this, right? Did they intend to say that? I mean, I can't imagine they did, right? But this is part of the reason why I think they've done a lot more course correction in recent years. There are three playable women characters in Super Mario Bros. Wonder. And if you want to be really generous, about the duplicated characters, like all the Toads and the Yoshis. It's actually roughly even gender split. Again, you have to be very generous to have that opinion. I still think it's not. But, you know, Mario's an old franchise. It's a big change for that franchise to do that. So that was very intentional. This is setting, this is story, this is the paintbrush that goes over the mechanics, right? So how is the character select a mechanic in the game? Because I think you could have a very reasonable argument to say that it's arbitrary, right? All the player abilities are the same. There's really no difference between them. But I think when you think about Mario Wonder, there's this great quote about including Daisy as a playable character. They already wanted to include Peach, but they basically said that including Daisy will help resolve fights within my own household, one of the designers said, because it wasn't just about a playable character as a woman, because only one person gets to be Peach. It's about the scarcity of female characters. And they caught that. And they said, like, that's just, we can't just put a woman in the game and that's going to check the box and we'll be fine now, because it's still a problem. And that is gameplay. When you have two people on a couch fighting over who gets to pick what, they are in the middle of playing that game. And that's part of the experience. And that's the kind of thing when you think about when you're designing your games and you're building your games, that none of that's in code, none of that is in your assets, but that is part of your game. And you have to think about your game in a more holistic, contextual space rather than just what goes into the project, I think. And this is an example where they're moving in the right direction, considering the failure of previous titles. Okay, batch of questions here. What other narrative elements can you think of that are actually sort of game mechanics in disguise? Is narrative and gameplay really that different? I think you're getting probably hints from my talk so far that I think that they are all one and the same. But there's a debate that they really are different, right? Treating them as one and the same maybe muddies things up. But how different are they, and in what ways are they different other than expression, right? Is it okay to make a game less fun in service of a message, right? Or maybe make a narrative less compelling or less impactful? If you want to say something with your game about a particular issue you care about, this is beyond a story you want to tell. If you want to deliver meaning and you want to change people's minds, if you want to make a political game, what's the duty you have to the player to give them a good experience? Or can you make anything fun, right? Is that not a barrier? Could you be confident enough to say that anything could be said and still make a banger, right? Is fun the point of games? I think people have talked about that in the past. I think there's a lot to be said about the unexplored territory of interactive media that is not designed purely for dopamine delivery or purely to bum you the fuck out, because those seem to be the two things we decide when we do interactive art. We're like, let's not make a fun game. Let's make a crushing game that really, makes you reflect on your stupid life. Like, it can't, those are extremes, I think. And that's kind of, that's the space we're playing in. This is a young medium. And I think when people get really insecure about games versus film or novels or other types of art, they go, well, games make way more money than film, so blah, blah, blah. But all of that is just insecurity, because I think we know deep down that games are a pretty young, immature art form. And I think it is really our duty to try to move it forward the best we can, or at least talk about how we could, because I think none of us really have the tools yet, because it's a young medium. So there's saying what you want versus not saying what you don't want to say. And this is some of the talking a little bit about chess comes back here. How do you prevent your game from saying something you don't intend it to, right? What should you spend more time on? Delivering the message you want, or guarding against interpretations you're not really interested in? How worried about that should you be? And are there ways to make that process easier? And how big does your message have to be, right? And how small could you make it? Is it your duty as an artist to say big things? I don't think so, but it's a lot of power we have as artists. So maybe you need to use the opportunity. Maybe you don't want your game to be about much. You want it to be about one little thing. That doesn't mean you spend a little effort on it, right? I mean, maybe it is. That's why it's on the question slide. All right, case three. This is a realistic kissing simulator. Who here has heard of that game? Just two, okay. It was a little indie hit. It got a lot of press attention. but not a lot of people played it. And that's sort of the classic example. Fair warning, I'm gonna come down on this game pretty hard. And I just want to like preface it by saying like, it had a lot of good intentions, but I think the execution is flawed, and I'm gonna get into why. It's a game about sexual consent. It's a big, big topic, right? Both players must press start to proceed. If one player doesn't press start, the game cannot continue. There can be no realistic kissing. Like that, what a powerful idea, right? Honestly, that alone is like the whole thing, right? You don't need to play the game. You get the message, right? And it's a very strong message. But you are compelled to consent. Because if you don't, you can't play this game. That's a bit of irony, right? You say no, the game will restart, and they'll ask again and again. And it'll not stop asking until you walk away or say yes. What does that say to you as a player? If both players don't maintain the kiss during gameplay, the game will end. And this makes a lot of sense, right? Because withdrawing consent, consent is not a permanent state, right? I think a lot of people, I'm not going to get into these details. I'm not really qualified to talk about that too much, but that's an important concept. Someone says yes, you should keep checking with them, right? That doesn't give you carte blanche, you know, for the rest of the encounter. And this game simulates that. If you stop kissing someone and enough of a beat passes where you don't re-engage, the game's over. Kiss is done. Makes a lot of sense. But denying or withdrawing consent is mechanically treated exactly the same as losing a game. That is how it feels. And this is more than me just saying it. I'm going to play a couple of examples. These are essentially clips from every single Let's Play, every single one I could find online.
Would you like to kiss me? Invite a kiss. What happens is I say no. No. What? Great. Best game ever. I think the boy's going to say no. Wife's going to be like, thanks for playing. Oh my God. Oh my God, wait, no, I was kidding. Thanks for playing. Oh my gosh.
Don't regret the ending.
No.
Oh, game's over. Okay, so apparently I had to play this fucking game. Premise like can't walk away, have to actually play the buggy game. So
would you like to kiss me? And then no. Okay. And that's the end of the game. No, just kidding. All right. Would you like to kiss me? And then obviously the lady would say yes. Yes, I would.
This game's so hard to say yes and shit. Finally.
Oh, they're done. Thanks for playing. That was it? All right.
Wouldn't that be the best? It'd basically some buff. Well, thanks for... I'm all done here. You call out a kiss?
Yeah, go in. Yeah, didn't push me away, honey.
No, she went for the kiss herself.
God damn it. God, I'm such a tease, aren't I? Yeah.
So you can see inclination to, you know, go in this direction for the humor.
Yeah, you
right?
Like it, don't you? Oh, God, this tongue is so sexy.
What? I didn't even kiss anyone. How is that a victory?
Can I go down her throat? Not that I would want to. Okay, don't do that, kids. All right. Yeah, she's hesitating a little bit. Come here, honey. Don't you worry.
So you can see the role-playing opportunities are legion and are not always what the developer intended.
Not work then. I don't understand at all. Maybe I'm missing the point here. I don't know.
Did I win before? Like when it said thanks for playing, or was it just like you're wasting my time? You're not trying hard enough.
So you see some bad faith interpretations in there from one example in particular, but a couple of like good faith attempts to understand what this game is about. That last example is pretty telling. Like, was it just that I wasn't trying hard enough? Like that is horrible. And that person is not a horrible person, right? But that's the meaning they got from it. The couple that was playing together earlier, that one really struck me as well. As the one was teasing the consent, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, which itself is pretty troubling. The other partner said, you know, don't hurt my feelings. by saying no. Like, that's what this game means to people. And that really, really scares me, because this game was heavily lauded in the press because of its premise, because of that first thing. Both players have to press start in order for the game to play. What a powerful idea. What an incredible aim for your game to teach people. And frankly, I think it's a good thing that this game got... people know about this game mostly through reading about it than actually playing it, because the gameplay does not support that message. In fact, it very, very strongly says the opposite in many situations. And that's the power that we have as developers. And when we want to say something important, that's the minefield you're in, right? That's the duty you have to treat those subjects with respect and to understand your clever idea, how that's really going to play out in the real world. So I'm worked up about that. Maybe you're not. I did hear some chuckles in the crowd. I won't judge you for that, some of those clips. But here's the questions. Are you responsible? Is it really your responsibility for how an audience interprets your work? And if that's true, and maybe it's not, but is there an upper limit to that? Can you really be blamed for someone whose experience is such that they are just geared to see your work in a way that's dangerous? Do you really have to account for all cases? How much of that misinterpretation risk is acceptable? Because sometimes when you want to say things really strongly, you need to say them subtly. And so you have to decide, this might not land, and am I okay if it doesn't? Because if you take from my talk that these are scary things to try, is that a chilling effect? Does that say, well, dang, if that's going to happen, I don't know that I should touch this? Maybe you're like, well, I need to go to, I need to audit 3 seminars on this substance-sensitive topic at the local university before I'm ready to approach this as an artist. Is that a fair thing to tell game developers? I mean, I'm kind of telling people that, but I don't think it's a fair thing to tell them. So it's not, I don't have an answer. What is unique about games' ability to convey meaning? Because one of the things about interactive arts is, it's no secret to people, but it puts you in the position to play out elements of story. And that includes games with no story, right? It's your story. The experience of you playing it is a story. And how you interact, and how you feel about yourself, and how you feel about characters that you play, topics you engage with. So what are the unique abilities that games have that other media don't? And what are the unique challenges? Because in a film, things are a lot more locked down. There are fewer... You don't know what the person in the audience is thinking, but you always know what's going to come next on the screen. And you can dance a little closer to the edge, because you always have control over where it lands, right? So I think this is a really interesting question. As someone who came from film and is making games, but still has a lot of ideas for what would make good films, but I don't make films anymore. So must you choose the correct medium for your message? Is it actually a bad thing to tell a film, quote unquote, story in a game, or vice versa? Or is it really just use the tools you've got? I would say that every piece of art is inefficient. There's probably much more efficient ways that you could, put a team of scientists on any piece of art. They could come up with a faster, better, more efficient way to say what it needed to say in that medium or another. But who cares, right? It's like the point of view of the artist matters. Or is it something you should be thinking more about? I had this great idea. It's incredible. But you know what? I don't write novels. So I'll do something else. Is that a sacrifice that you make? Or is it a sacrifice to your potential audience who won't get to see that from you? When you develop your artistic voice in games, think about that compared to other media. Is that something, I want to make a roguelike, or I want to make a platformer, I've never made this before, I've never made that before. I think we as game designers, as a class, are much more interested in novelty, in trying things we've never tried before, and also, at the same time, honing what we're really good at. But I think we don't talk about what that means for our artistic voice. When you make something really good, and then you want to make something next, what is it you're hoping to do? Are you hoping to say, well, you know what? I think this will get more player engagement. I think I can make this, but bigger. I think I can make this, but smaller and more refined. But do you think about, I'm going to make this, but I'm going to, the things I've been saying, I'm going to see if I can say them better. I hear that from nobody. And I don't know if it's, I don't think it's not true for game developers. I think a lot of us do feel that way. I just don't think we use that language. We don't talk about games as an art form. We just say that they're art. And that's, you know, something that I think we could do better at. And is there anything you just can't say in games? Like, and if there isn't, like, has anybody tried? Can you test that theory? Is interactive media something that there's a certain thing you want to say? Is there any topic where you could say, hey, you know what? Any form of interactivity will dilute what I want to say with this. And so it's definitely off limits for games. Is there anything that's true of? I mean, maybe. I don't know that it is, but I think there's reason to be optimistic that that's not the case. But also maybe there's a reason to be deliberate and thoughtful and say maybe you want the right tool for the job. So I'm really of two minds about a lot of this third batch of questions. And I'm really curious to see what all of you think about it.
Hey folks, it's me again. That's right, me again. The me from the beginning of the show, not the one you were just listening to at the end of my talk. That's right, that's the end of the talk. But there's a lot more discussion ahead, and I promise you'll really enjoy it. That's really one of two pitches I'm going to make to you here in the middle of the show. The other one is really not one of our normal ones, because when Ellen and Steven aren't here, I get to break the rules. What I'm going to ask you to do is look into your local game dev communities. I gave this talk at the game dev meeting for our local community, and I didn't know that community existed for a really long time when I was starting out making games. And so if you're feeling, hey, I live in a small area, or hey, I live in an area without a lot of industry, or maybe I live in a place where there's lots of this type of industry and not the type that I do, look at it a little harder. See if there's any IGDA chapters in your area. That's a good resource. But there's also other game dev groups. And you know what? Here's the other thing. If you really can't find anything, start one of your own. And here's the double secret, is that if there is one out there and you can't find it, start one of your own, and then they will find you, and then you can combine. Community is hard. Joining a community is hard. Starting a community is hard. Managing a community is hard. But I'm really laying into this because it's really been very important to my journey as a game developer. And I know it will be to you if this is not already your story as well. And if this is a lesson that you don't need to learn because you've learned it already, teach it to somebody else. And not just the folks who are hanging out with you in the community you're part of. Reach out. Try to get more people involved, however you can manage that. It's very, very gratifying when you do. So, with that said, second half of the show is as good as it is because of the local community that I am a part of. The people who prompt and ask questions and have interesting stories that I could then elaborate on the talk that I just gave. Some of the things that I say in the second half of the show, I think are more interesting than the things I prepared because I was spurred on by the folks in the community who asked great questions and had really interesting things to say. We shall hear right now. Well, right now, if you have the Patreon ad-free version of the show, if you don't, you gotta wade through a couple of ads before you get there. Haha! Secret Patreon pitch at the end, patreon.com/textypub.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
So that is it. That's my whole deal. If anyone has questions now, we're still on the stream. We can talk about it. Anything stand out to you? Anything you're not sure of? Trent's coming over with the microphone.
All right. So full disclosure, I am a longtime chess player, so I had some very interesting thoughts about what you were stating about chess and how it was presented as a war game, but also how high-level players are often viewed as jerks, to use your terminology.
Sure.
That said, do you think it's necessarily a byproduct of playing chess that develops players that are jerks?
That's a really good question, because it might. You could maybe, because when I say high level, I'm talking about grandmasters, the few celebrities in the chess world. That's kind of the era. That's the cliche I'm talking about, right? And I think this is another area of mine, which is about like high level competition, the sort of be better at all costs. Now, how much of the cliche about chess players is attributable to the qualities of chess versus the fact that it's incredibly high stakes and incredibly high competition level? But I think that quality is not found in as many other categories that has that. But I think there is a mix. So I think you're right to bring it up, because I wouldn't say it's 100% due to the game. But I think the game does allow for that in a way that it doesn't necessarily have to. But, you know, I don't have any thoughts on that. I'm not here to critique chess. It's pretty well honed and optimized as an experience. And I quite like it myself.
Yeah, and I bring it up because for myself, I consider myself a very empathic person. And on that note, I found it really interesting how you drew that parallel with chess being taught as an empathy thing, because in thinking about it, that made me realize, maybe that did have an influence on how I became such an empathic person. But for me, not that I'm necessarily grandmaster level, I'm not claiming that, but the way I view chess is such that I definitely need to understand what the other person is doing, but I'm also at a point where my goal coming into it is I'm going to do the best that I can, and if that means I lose, so be it.
Right, right. And I think that's something, my theory is that that's something that people, because I believe people are good as a default quality, right? I think people start out good, that's their default position. I think that's something you have to hold on to. I think that those environments can challenge you to hold on to that notion of like, I'm only competing against myself, and I'm going to make sure that when we shake hands, because that's part of the rules, I'm not going to just do it perfunctorily like I've seen on television, where they don't really mean it. I'm going to really, when I say good game, I'm really going to mean it. I think that's something you do have to fight to hold on to.
Yeah, I would concur. Yeah, not really any other point, just an interesting topic that I wanted to tease out.
Yeah, but that's broader. When you think about games that are, when you're trying to make games that are highly competitive, that are skill-based, that are multiplayer, think about what you're putting your players through in order to do that, right? The more data you give them about how their performance, the more opportunities you give them to get just a little bit better, the more perfect your system is so that it's not accountable to randomness or to input lag, the more that the player can blame themselves or blame another player, the more perfect your competitive environment is, the fewer barriers there are to someone just going, it's just a game. And is that what you want, or is that not what you want?
Yeah, and I think those are definitely worthwhile questions to think about. So I think it's good to bring these things up and tease them out.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else have questions or thoughts?
So on your second point about Peach, I saw that in real life. So I'm married. I have three kids. They're now grown up now. But when they played Gauntlet, do you remember Gauntlet?
Oh, yeah.
My wife always had to play the sorceress because she was a woman. And it was interesting like that. Or another conversation was they're in the minivan driving, and this is when the second series of Star Wars came out. Sorry. But they're like, oh, I'm Ben Kenobi, and I'm, you know, Anakin Skywalker. And my wife goes, well, who am I? Well, you're Princess Amidala, Mom. It always was a gender role thing. So they were learning it through film. They were learning it through games. And so I can really see your point. And even to the point where there was times where they question, can you do that, Mom, because you're a woman? Because they just of the stimulation they were getting from TV and shows.
Yeah.
And so I can see where that point is coming from. But I also can see where games, whether people get the wrong message from it when you start it out. It's very, very hard to control that message. Once it's like I've heard from authors and filmmakers that once you, and musicians, is once you create a song and release it, it's no longer yours. It's whatever that person thinks of it is, good or bad.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And yeah, if you believe in death of the author, then make sure you think about what you leave when you're dead, right? And yeah, it's hard. It's hard to know what that is. And particularly, yeah, when it comes to representation, I think one of the things that people really struggle with, and I say when I say people, I mean people who look like me, white men, struggle with the idea that, like, well, I watched Alien and I empathize with Ripley. Why can't women? What's the problem there? And I think it's just because it's about defaults. And about when you're always of the understanding that a protagonist is similar to you, or you mostly see them and look like you, then when they don't look like you, you can still identify with them because they're a protagonist and you understand what a protagonist is. But when a little girl or a person of color sees someone that looks like them, that means more to them because they've not seen it before. And when you think about the female characters in Mario Wonder, and you're like, well, If I want a better world, don't I want my daughter to want to play as Luigi as much as she wants to play as Peach? And that is not the world we live in right now. It is a much more complicated subject than it's well beyond the scope of this talk. But I do like to touch on it when I talk about this broadly, because I think people can, it clicks, because people do see it in their own lives.
April O'Neil here.
What's that?
April O'Neil here?
Yes.
Yes. That's who I was. Do you have a favorite Mario character to play as?
I tend to play as Luigi because I was a middle child. And so Luigi was, that felt like who I was when I was a kid, right? I think as an adult, I've thought a lot about how I play games, and I tend not to put myself in there. When I was a child, I certainly did. But I love playing as Peach in Mario Wonder. And I'm really into the new Peach game, by the way, which is amazing. But I also recognize the privilege I have to be able to set a lot of that aside and just pick something based on my sense of aesthetics or my sense of my sort of artistic affinity. I get to do that because I grew up without the barriers that would keep me from being able to do that. So Luigi is the answer.
Which character do you hate?
What's that?
Which character do you hate?
Which character do I hate?
Yeah.
It's talking Mario Universe, so like I can't think of any.
Okay, so let's talk the kissing game.
Yeah.
At what point does the response to the game become the message? Like the controversy is actually the message. Does that make sense?
I think I kind of understand what you're saying. I think I'd push back a little bit because I saw this. I have a long-standing grudge against this game, so which is not fair. Like I say, I think it is. I do want to make it really clear. Like someone took this chance, and like I think they totally failed. But like, good God, like, congratulations for having the courage to try it. I mean, I think they stopped before they should have. They stopped before they were done, right? I have endless criticism for their approach, but like, that's an it's an important thing for them to have tried. But I think the reason I push back a little bit on that is because I've watched people play it. I was at IndieCade, I think 2015, when they were showing it off. And my first reaction, I was seeing people play it and laughing, and because it's this funny, you know, physics, and seeing people do it, just thinking like, oh, no one's actually getting this message. And then searching for Let's Plays, my intent was to say, I want to see how the reaction of this is. Because I knew what I had seen, I knew my reaction to it, I'd seen other people's reaction to it from back when. But when I wanted to go dig in the past and find those Let's Plays, I was expecting more of a mix. More of a people being like, oh, I don't quite understand this, or oh, like, I get the point of it. But like I said, that is clips from every single Let's Play I found. And then, you know, not a fair test, because Let's Plays have a heightened presentational sense. So there's maybe a little bit of that that influences that, that I can't quite account for. But I think in that instance for that game, I think it is an unqualified disaster in terms of how that comes across. I think the quotes I highlight in that reel of people really, the things they say and the message they take away from that. Now, the question is, then they read about it. They read the artist statement. Does that change them in one way or another? Which is the more powerful message, right? Because the people in those videos say those things and come off that way because they're a product of their culture, and then the game did not work to fix that? Or is it the game is reinforcing those things? I mean, maybe I am being too hard on it. Maybe it's not reinforcing those things. It's just bringing them out. But it's not making those people, you know, any less, you know, likely to appreciate the message of consent at the heart of it. And then maybe the article on Polygon made them think about it more, and it was a success, the sum of it. I think that's broader than any of us can know for sure. But I think if you wanted to make a game where the reaction was where the player is meant to reflect on their own response, which is a very powerful thing. Films do this, where when they show violent scenes, they do play them up in a way that is meant to be titillating to an audience, but then they frame them in a such that you're actually meant to feel a little bad about your own reaction, but that it needs to be in context with the experience. And I think if that was your intent, to showcase a game about consent, where you played as someone and you just understood your learned behaviors, you understood how this thing works, and then it reveals to you more, that would be a powerful thing. This game does not do that. This game intends to, from the start screen, it expects you to get the message, and that's it. And I think because it's a fun, silly game, they kind of forgot to do the rest of the homework, I think.
All right, I want to tackle this from a little bit of a different angle now. So everything that you've been saying about messaging so far, there's an implication that someone is taking the time to figure out what is the messaging? Is the messaging doing what I think it's doing? But implicit in that is you have the time and the resources to figure those things out.
Right.
Now, for me, one of the things that I'm dealing with for my current game, Dice Tower, is that it's a platformer where you control a character that in current story terms doesn't have a specific purpose for looking or behaving the way that they do, but because essentially I don't have the time or resources to contract someone to make multiple versions of this character, there is one singular representation, and that's something that I've gone back and forth on a lot, where that's ideally what I want to do, but I don't know if I can afford to put in the time to and the resources in order to get that outcome. So I wonder how much of this kind of stagnation or singular messaging comes down to, do I really have the time to change the message to say something that I really want to say?
Right. So you're talking about the character select is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say I won't have any comment on that, because I think there are games which do a really good job where character select is part of the messaging, and other games which are like, this is the character we're writing, and this is the character you're playing in. And I think that I don't have a preference. As a player, I might have a preference, but as a designer, I don't think there's a wrong way to do that. I will say that you're thinking about it right, which is that, like, if I can't do character select, I want to, but I can't. So then you kind of are burdened with making your character, understanding how it comes off contextually within the setting of your world, whether it's fantasy or abstracted or realistic. You kind of are burdened with understanding what that is. And I think when you say lack of time and resources, I think that is an out. I think that lack of time and resources is why a lot of indie games are missing a lot of things. But I think if we want to say games are art, you have to put in the time to understand that. And I think that's not fun to say, and I don't want to like point a finger at everybody in the room or everyone in the world and say, like, you're all bad at this. But I think as a medium, we don't realize that, I guess because we can just get away with it because no one's telling us that, like, you should probably think a little bit more about what your game says, which isn't to say you need to spend 50% of your time doing that. But I think looking cool, working right, playing well, none of that work does that, I think. And I think we're so exhausted from doing those three things. So incredibly exhausted. Like, it's pretty depressing to say games are hard. Now, let me tell you all about how they're harder than you can possibly imagine. But if, like I said, if we want games to be art, and honestly, we don't have a choice in that. Games are art, right? Like, if you say, well, my games aren't art, my games are just fun. Like, sorry to tell you, like, your games are art too. Now, the consequences, you have to also think about that, right? Like, well, you know what? My little abstract game, my little indie platformer, I don't have the time to even think about how it's coming off to people. You can be heartened to know that the consequences of the misinterpretation are pretty low. It depends on how, frankly, how artsy-fartsy you are. Like, I want to care. Sometimes people really, really care about the last pixel. There are other people in the, you know, if you want to be obsessively thinking about your messaging and the meanings and the expressions, that same kind of obsession can apply. That said, you can also say, you know what, I don't care about every last pixel. And people will still say that art looks pretty good. And so you could also be a person to say, Liz, I'm going to care a little bit, but I'm going to budget. Because what I think I'm telling people is, please care about this. But at the same time, like with everything else in your game, it's a multidisciplinary art form. It all has to be taken in moderation. And like, I can't tell you how much to care about that part of it. I just hope that you think about it instead of just knowing you can get away without thinking about it.
Yeah, and I think the angle that I'm trying to convey is that of, there's only so much I can do with what I have. Now, like, if you're writing a book, it's one person controlling everything. I mean, assuming there's not multiple authors and whatnot, but you have one person that can control literally everything that goes onto the page. With a film, it can be a team of people varying size, but the outcome of that is one film, one representation. So in the end, you still have a high degree of control of what gets put on the final film. With a game, there's a lot of varying ways that things can come out based on what you put in, and every variation that you put in increases the amount of time it takes to evaluate all of the combinations of things that you've put in, to the point where at some point, unless you have infinite amount of time and infinite amount of resources, there has to be choices about what you choose to put in. And not that that doesn't mean you can't think about these things, but it introduces a scope of how far you can actually go with finding the right thing before you just run out of time and resources.
You're absolutely right. And I want to make a comparison by just shifting a couple of things. So let's say you have a game design, you've got it all on paper, and you're like, I'm going to have 100 different enemy types in my game. Awesome. That's so fucking cool. It all lines up. I've designed it perfectly. It's not too many. People are going to tell me it's too many, but I've designed it in such as 100 enemy types. But you know what? I only have the art budget for like three of them. Okay, I'll make three, and there's four categories. So like, that doesn't really work. But you know what I'll do? I'll make three types, and then for the fourth type, I'll just warp the mesh. And then for all the different variations, I'll do like color swaps. And like, that'll work fine. And then you'll get terrible reviews from people being like, There's so many enemy types, but there's only a couple of art styles. That's essentially exactly what I'm talking about here. If you think there's, you're designing a game where there's so many possible interpretations, or there's so many, there's so, I have so little time to really think about my message and how I'm delivering it to people, or I don't really, I can't really think about how this is going to interact with the message I'm trying to deliver here or whatever, whatever, then maybe what you need to do is scope down some of your other things so that that thing is now digestible. And because we think about that in a lot of other different areas, we say like, oh, we only have enough art for a couple of enemy types. Well, you know what? If we change the weapon types down, we'll have a little bit more art budget. And then I know it's going to hurt the design, but I'm going to take it down to 50 enemy types because that's what I have budget for everything else. The 100 types always so good. It was so good, you guys. 100 types. It was perfect design. And I could prove it. But you know what? I didn't have the budget for the things I needed to make that work in the multidisciplinary field. And when you talk about how games are different from film and from books, and that means that there's so many more possibilities for getting it wrong, I would hope you flip that on its head. There are so many things you can do with it. That should excite you. That should, I mean, because we just as a medium have not engaged that space, I think, enough to know that that's not something that's scary. That's something that's thrilling. And I hope that's something that you all take away from it, because it is, it can be very depressing, but I hope it can also be really inspiring and very hopeful, because games are so much more powerful than those mediums because of that fact.
Cool. Good talk.
Hello, Mark.
Hey.
I thought it was really cool that you brought up the fact that the game actually continues outside of the TV or the computer monitor. This was one thing that I really started to notice when we were developing Joggernauts.
Joggernauts is a great example of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I really started to notice that when people would like still be talking about it afterwards, you know, or like, I think that's the reason why we kept really pursuing it, you know. And we thought a lot about all the stuff you're talking about. Like, you know, we didn't put any human characters in it because we didn't want to alienate anybody. They're all aliens. But still, it was like, how do we make this game fun for everybody? Because the whole idea of the game is anybody can play it, and it's about working together. So like, everybody should be represented in some way or shape or form. So I was pretty excited when I saw that depth of like outside of the TV interactions. And we started using it in pitching material. We started using like, you know, this game will, you'll lose friends, you know, with this game. And it made it more than it could have been just on screen. So yep. I think that like what you're saying about that is totally, totally right and cool that, you know, people are starting to see that sort of depth in games.
And I will just to praise Joggernauts a little bit, because it's like, oh, it's a game that tests friendships, right? But what it actually does is it teaches cooperation, because it gives you tools to mess up other players. And there are consequences to doing that. And those consequences are not in the game. They're on the couch. And so I think that's important. That dynamic is really important. And the fact that you give players the ability to mess things up at will, I think that's a really, really strong thing. And at indie scale, it delivers something that is a very complicated social dynamic and message for people. And it's not something that people walk away from being like, oh, that game really made me think, right? It's like, no, it made them behave and understand. I'm glad that you guys caught that early and were able to leverage it, because that's an example of finding a thing that works, right?
Thank you for sharing the kissing game. That's something that I had not seen before. And as a first-time viewer, I appreciated that. And I also appreciated when you mentioned that the game began at the start button. That got me thinking about ways of improving it, ways of onboarding, especially. And you likely have been in situations in your life where you've been in the wrong meeting. Like, you realize that you're the odd one out. Or you might not go to a little boutique art house for a film expecting to see a certain I almost said AAA movies, like big screen Hollywood films. And that's the thing that I think was really lacking in here for the people. I almost, when you're watching the Let's Play video, it was almost a bit of a schadenfreude, a little bit of a, you know, laughing at their mistakes because they didn't get the message what this game was even about. There was no box art available for them for the onboarding. And so I think it's a little bit sad. I feel a little bit of empathy for them being put on stage in the wrong message, having the background of conventions of like, they're not collecting coins. They're not getting to the next level. So I got to thinking more about that magic circle of who's going to be invited to this game, what's going to be experienced. I really love your through line, all of these, of having that meaning behind the game experience and thinking about that. Because there's oftentimes I've seen artwork where people look at it and like, I don't get it. And that level of engagement is often either handed to you in a video game or it is, in this case, completely missed.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think it's important when you're playtesting, think about, you know, either recording or taking a lot of notes for how people respond to things you're doing. Because, you know, like in that, I mean, with one notable exception, everyone in that compilation, it wasn't their fault, right? Like, I mean, maybe they're
shock jocks
to certain reactions and there's certain frustrating things to hear them say, but they were spurred to that by the game. And when they're put on display like that, like I just did, like they do look bad, and at least certainly the way I'm framing it. And that's not fair to them, right? And so think about, yeah, your work's position in other people's lives is a really valuable thing to think about. Not just, am I going to get a good review? Are they going to like it? Like that's one thing. It's important to think about that, but that's not the end of your relationship with your player.
I think where you've got to, where it comes down to trade-offs, that's where I'm really looking at it too, because like I'm thinking about the messaging, and by thinking about the messaging, it's doing what you're arguing that we should be doing as game developers and thinking about the messaging. The decision that comes out of it is going to be based on a lot of factors, but the act of actually putting thought into that I definitely agree with, and I think that's what you were arguing as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you, again, like I was saying in the sort of middle of the talk, sometimes you just want what you're saying to be very small. Yes, you're an artist, but like you're not trying to change the world. You're not trying to solve climate change. You just have a little thing you want to say. That doesn't necessarily mean your job is small, but also you shouldn't feel burdened with making your thing a big statement. I think small art is really valuable, and it should be really valued, but it does. Sometimes it's not easier.
Hi, good talk. Great prompts. Nice. One thing that was going through my mind is I love 4X games, Civilization in particular, and I think that's apropos where you're obviously dominating, exploiting civilizations and people, and how do you design the narrative around that? But the point that it sparked is I recently read Sid Meier's autobiography, and I was excited because there was part of that where he leaned into the criticism of how do you deal with exploitive games. And I was excited when he got to that part of the book where he acknowledged the criticism. And then I don't remember exactly what he said, but I felt let down in where he basically sidestepped and said, well, it's not that deep. That's how we did it. It was fun. Moving on. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, you could apply my rubric and really just take everyone to task for not giving this sort of thing enough thought. But I think it's also a choice you make. And sometimes it's a choice based on what you have time for, what you're interested in. And you've seen this in reviews, like responses to Steam reviews, where some player complains about some mechanic or something. And the response is the developer saying, yes, that's not a mistake. We chose to do that. And I know that it's not ideal. And we knew that, but we chose that. And so I have a lot of criticisms about Civilization, particularly it's a trivialization of the notion of one more turn, as if that's not just as exploitative of a player's time. But aside from that, I think that, yes, I feel you. That is disappointing. It's like, yeah, here's a problem. Well, whatever. Like, that's frustrating. But at the same time, like, it's good at least that he got that far to make that choice. Because that's the main criticism I have. If you're someone who makes those mistakes, who who doesn't put the right amount of effort into a thing. Like, I can't tell you what's the right amount for your game, but if you're not thinking about it, that's where I have a problem with you. But that's actually a pretty low bar to clear. So I think we're all capable. I think the work past that is a lot, but you can certainly be, and you can justify it to yourself, to your players, to the world, that, like, you know what? I know this could be troublesome, but I don't have the budget for it, and these other things are so important to me that I'm going to take that risk, that misinterpretation risk. And I think that is still an artistic choice, and you can make it.
Oh my goodness, hello.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, I'm so happy I got to see this talk. Yay. So I love this talk for a million different reasons, but just thinking about it, like, I like coming at games from a very, like, thematic approach, like tone, vibes, like the theming of a game is usually what I go for first. And I honestly am just curious how you would see, or how you see, like, theming / tone overlapping or being the exact same thing or completely separate from messaging in a game. Just how you see those influencing each other or not.
I will say, if you listen to Nice Games Club long enough, you will start to get annoyed at me saying that everything is everything, because that is truly how I feel. And I think it's easy for someone who is a multidisciplinarian or who is a solo developer or who works on multiple things. It's maybe easier for me to say that because I work in multiple fields. It's much harder when you're on a team of people. You're responsible for art, you're responsible for code, you're responsible for design. Mm-hmm. Then the togetherness of it all, that's a bigger job, I think, for a team. It's why AAA is the worst at this, I think, which is, again, not exactly their fault. It's systemic. But when it comes to that notion of theming, I think that's a conversation where you have to be ready, especially if you feel really strongly about something, to identify where the sizzle points are with the design, with the structure, with even the scope of other things, with the story, with the other parts of the thing that are, or even just like the art capacity of the project and your theme. Because you might say, like, listen, this is the way I want it to look, this is the way I want it to feel, the vibe. But you know what? In order for me to achieve that, it's going to start messing with some of these other things because we don't have our scopes are not aligned. So let's talk about that. Let me present my vision, and is it enough to change what you're all working on? And if it's not, then I need to be open to let those restrictions change what I'm working on. And that's, you know, teamwork, and that's the lifelong lesson, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's everything is everything. It really does all come down to that, very annoyingly so.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, that's awesome. Especially on, like, sort of mid-range size projects for teams, or teams where you have multiple people who feel very strongly about different approaches to it. Like, if one person cares more about the messaging than the theming, or if people have conflicting opinions on how they or what they should be communicating, it's always really interesting to see how that levels out and ends up in, like, the final product of the game.
Yeah. I'll get on my soapbox and I'll say, what you want to say, you should feel strongly about it. You should be deliberate about it. You should let nothing stand in the way of what you want to say or your intention. And I do not think that's contradictory with the fact that all art is compromise. And some of that compromise is to your intent, right? You weren't stopped. That was just the path you took. And so I think the more we understand as an industry that every little damn thing everybody does contributes to that message. It's not the narrative designer's job. They might feel the brunt of it, but the person doing the UI, they're going to have a huge impact because the player's going to see that screen more than most other screens in certain types of games. And so you think about the type of project you're doing, and if not everyone has to be good at it, do you know what I mean? Like, but if everyone understands that they share the burden and the responsibility and the thrill of being able to deliver that message, and everybody's on the same page as to what it might be and how precise you want to be, what singular thing you want to say versus 30 things you want to say. You know, that's up to your team to decide how specific or how deliberate you want to be with that, or how much you want to leave open to modification as you test. But if everybody understands that they're part of that process, then that kind of interrelation between departments becomes easier because you can say like, hey, you know what? I know you worked a lot on this, but it's also important to you that it does this thing. And interacting with the other things, it's not going to do that. So let's, instead of saying, hey, you need to change it, it's like, hey, let's all work together so that can better do what we all want it to do. It's kind of Pollyannish. It's easier said than done, but that's how you make collaborative work.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions?
We exhausted the room. I wouldn't mind a yes to that.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thank you, everybody. It was really good to have this conversation on top of it as well.
Can you believe, after all that talking, I still need to do an outro for this episode? I mean, those are the rules, I guess. Wait. Ellen and Steven are gone, right? I can break them rules. All right. That's it. That's the show. Patreon. Email us. Whatever. Dale posts on social media. Next week, we'll be doing a nice thinking. All right. Great. So until we start again, remember to play nice and make nice.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.